I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. President Obama called Antonin Scalia one of the most consequential judges and thinkers to serve on the Supreme Court. Scalia died this past weekend at the age of 79 after almost 30 years on the court. Known for his deeply held opinions, his combative and sometimes scathing dissents, his surprising friendship with fellow Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, his colorful use of language, think jiggery-pokery, and his originalist view of the Constitution. Here he is in 2011 on the University of California's TV show called Legally Speaking.
We're not supposed to know what the current society wants. That's not how we're supposed to vote. So why are you going to entrust this institution with keeping the Constitution up to date if that's what you want to do, which it shouldn't be? You know, even if that were the object, you've picked the worst institution.
That institution being the U.S. Supreme Court. Well, joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Jeffrey Rosen, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center here in Philadelphia, just across the street from WHYY. He's got a new book coming out on June 1st called Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. Jeffrey Rosen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Wonderful to be here, as always.
And also with us is Laura Little. She's the Charles B. Klein Professor of Law and Government and Senior Advisor to the Dean at Temple University's Beasley School of Law, working on a book called Humor and the Law. And Laura Little, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here.
Jeffrey, let me begin with you. You wrote a little bit about Justice Scalia. What would you say is his major influence on the Supreme Court?
Well, President Obama was correct in talking about how hugely influential he was. And I would agree with Justice Elena Kagan when she was dean of Harvard Law School. She said that Justice Scalia, more than anyone else, transformed the terms of constitutional debate in the 20th century. He compelled liberals as well as conservatives to make arguments about constitutional text and history, to care about original understanding, and to try to persuade justices that history pointed their way. Now, Justice Scalia, I think, has to be ranked as among the most influential justices of the 20th century, along with William Brennan, the great liberal giant, who we've learned in the past few weeks since and days since Justice Scalia's passing, Scalia actually admired Brennan for his constitutional passion and admired other liberal justices. You mentioned Justice Ginsburg, but he also reached across the aisle with his friendships with Justice Kagan, who paid affectionate tribute to him. He was an admirer of Sotomayor. He really, within the court, was quite bipartisan in his friendships. But in addition to that, Scalia is the most influential justice since Louis Brandeis. You mentioned that I have this book out about him. Brandeis is interesting both because of the length of his confirmation hearing. He was nominated in an election year and was, took 125 days, but he was confirmed. But Brandeis, like Scalia, was a constitutional visionary who had a passionate vision of what the Constitution should be. And Scalia, although he insisted on the necessity of separating your political preferences from your constitutional conclusions, which we insist on at the Constitution Center, I was inspired by that challenge of Scalia when I was a law student, and I've tried to insist on it ever since. At the same time, Scalia did believe strongly in certain principles, in unitary executive power, in separation of powers, in the ability of states to enforce morality. And he argued for them with such zest and such passion. It was, you know, even hearing that clip of his voice was moving, and I miss that voice. You can just hear the passion which he cared about the Constitution, his humor, and it was really because of that fervor and zest. It wasn't a bloodless academic enterprise for him. It was a crusade to enforce what he conceived of as constitutional fidelity and to ensure that this document that he loved so much was preserved. So for that sense, he was really just a huge, influential, towering figure.
Laura, there are so many descriptions of Justice Scalia. One of them was that he was a court of one, that he was an uncompromising justice. How do you see his term on the court and his legacy?
Well, I think one of the most remarkable things about the fact that he was able to set the terms of constitutional debate is that he actually did not write that many significant majority opinions. He didn't tend to get those assignments because, in fact, he wrote what he wanted to write and what didn't appear particularly interested in writing to get a majority of the justices. For that reason, he wouldn't generally get assignments to write in the more controversial cases. So he accomplished what he did in setting the debate by the force of his personality, by the force of his friendship, by sort of playing in part to an outside audience, not just playing to his fellow justices. That is, he wrote amazingly influential dissents. The general audience of dissents, besides law professors and people that love the Constitution, are law students. So he was writing for the next generation of lawyers. He was also very, very much interested in getting the message of originalism out to the general public, and therefore had a lot of public events in which he expressed that preference.
Again, many quotes. One of them, Scalia saying the Constitution is dead, dead, dead. I mean, the idea that you have to go back, what, almost 250 years to understand what the framers were thinking? I mean, that really, Jeffrey, guided how he thought about current issues?
It did, but he was not averse to translating the Constitution in light of new technologies. He said, of course, the Constitution has to apply to technologies the framers couldn't have anticipated. And some of his most beautiful and fiery opinions come in cases where he believed that the majority was allowing new technologies to infringe on ancient liberties. He had a wonderful dissent in a case where the majority said it's fine to take DNA samples from a suspect on arrest and to run it through a DNA database. And Scalia said, I find it impossible to imagine that our hardy forebears who wrote the Constitution would have opened their mouths for royal inspection. He also dissented from a decision allowing drug tests of custom officials, saying it was an immolation of privacy and human dignity and symbolic opposition to drug use. And he wrote a majority opinion in a case forbidding tracking someone 24/7 with a global positioning system device on the grounds that the framers would have disapproved of any seizure intended to collect information. So he said the framers are concerned about general warrants that allow officials to collect a lot of information about you without individualized suspicion, and he was perfectly willing to apply that to technologies that the framers could not have envisioned.
Would it be fair to say, Laura, that he was passionate about the Fourth Amendment, about searches and seizures, and the First Amendment?
Yes, that's absolutely right. I think a lot of conservative justices are passionate about the First Amendment because they don't want to be muzzled, if nothing else. In terms of his approach to constitutional interpretation and his approach to originalism and textualism, that is, being faithful to the actual words in the Constitution. He said, I'm an originalist, but I'm not a nut.
Yes.
That is, that he was realistic in the idea that, in fact, these are old words and old concepts that need to be applied in the modern era.
Let me play another clip. And so much has been said about Justice Scalia's personality. And this is an interview that he did on 60 Minutes. It goes back to the year 2008.
I attack ideas. I don't attack people. And some very good people have some very bad ideas. I could be charming and combative at the same time. What's contradictory between the two? I love to argue. I've always loved to argue. And I love to point out the weaknesses of the opposing arguments. It may well be that I'm something of a shin kicker.
A shin kicker. Let me go back to you, Laura, because I was reading some of the dissents, one where he seemed to almost go after Sandra Day O'Connor. This goes back, obviously, a couple of years, but it seemed like some of his dissents were rather personal and critical.
That's correct. I think he thought that it was more important to, in fact, make his point and make his jurisprudential point than necessarily to sort of save the feelings of his fellow justices.
And yet his fellow justices, I mean, I don't know about Sandra Day O'Connor, but certainly some of the justices with whom he probably disagreed about the Constitution, Jeffrey, seemed to be friends with him.
They did, although Justice O'Connor actually responded to that decision you're referring to, where he said that her decision could not be taken seriously, and she said, "Sticks and stones may break my bones." That's probably not actually true. So she was a bit hurt. Justice Ginsburg, his dear friends say, you know, he sometimes he drives me crazy, but he always makes me laugh. But I think there was a sense, despite the fact that he did have these really good relations with Justice Kagan, who he went duck hunting with, a tribute to his and her bravery, you know, Justice Sotomayor with liberal. We learned from recent accounts that when Justices Breyer and Ginsburg were nominated, Scalia said to the White House, you know, if you keep sending up nominees like this, I'm going to have to become a Democrat. So he really respected people. On the other hand, especially in his later years, his dissents became quite acerbic. You know, in the Obergefell gay marriage dissent, he said, "I'd rather put my head in a bag than join a dissent like this." And when I've asked Justice Scalia's clerks about this, they've acknowledged that he probably became more less guarded in his later years, and their explanation was, we all need editors, and in his earlier years, his clerks felt emboldened to actually tell him to sleep on it and to take out the really extreme language. And in his later years, his clerks didn't feel they had the standing to do that. So some of those dissents, these clerks suggested, might have been a little ill-advised in their rhetoric.
Let me read a dissent that he wrote in the Lawrence case. This had to do with gay rights. He said, many Americans do not want persons who openly engage in homosexual conduct as partners in their business, as scoutmasters for their children, as teachers in their children's schools, or as boarders in their home. They view this as protecting themselves and their families from a lifestyle that they may believe to be immoral and destructive. Now, Lawrence goes back in a couple of years, Laura, but nonetheless, that's a pretty horrifying thing to say. I mean, that sounds like discrimination to me.
I think he saw himself, particularly in his dissents, as taking the role of providing like warning as to the consequence of the majority's decision. One possible approach in a dissent is actually trying to mitigate or reduce the force of the majority's decision. He generally took the opposite, which was to say, this is stupid and this is going to cause the world to come to an end in some way or another, as he saw the world should be.
Well, and he predicted in the Lawrence decision, Jeffrey, what happened, right?
He did. He was very prescient. He said, starting in gay rights decisions like Lawrence and even earlier, this is going to lead to gay marriage, even though the majority said it wasn't. And then when it did, he basically said, I told you so. I would say just this in his – I agree that that language is strong.
Yes.
He wasn't himself saying, I believe this. He was saying the people who voted for this law believe it, and therefore it's the court's job to – allow the majority to have its way. And he did make a very powerful point in that Lawrence dissent that I always like to ask my students to respond to. He said, basically, in this case, the court is saying you can't enforce morality, that basically that's not a legitimate governmental interest. And Scalia said, when did it become illegal to enforce morality? For almost 200 years, it was taken for granted that the states could enforce health, safety, and morals. What changed in the Constitution? The majority never had a good answer to that question, and I've never heard a great one, so I think it was a good question.
Well, we are talking about what many people have been talking about this week, the legacy, the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. Died at the age of 79 over the weekend. That's Jeffrey Rosen, President and CEO of the National Constitution Center. Also with us, Laura Little, Professor of Law and Government, Senior Advisor to the Dean of Temple University's Beasley School of Law. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times, and we're talking about the legacy, the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. And again, our guests are Jeffrey Rosen, President and CEO of the National Constitution Center here in Philadelphia. He's got an upcoming book, in fact, due on June 1st, called Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. Laura Little with us as well, the Charles B. Klein Professor of Law and Government, and again, Senior Advisor to the Dean at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. She's working on a book on humor and the law. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and tell us what you think of the legacy, the life, the personality even of Justice Antonin Scalia. Let me play another clip, and this is Scalia speaking at Oxford Union. This is 2008, and it's about Roe v. Wade. Let's give it a listen.
You think there ought to be a right to abortion? No problem. The Constitution says nothing about it. create it the way most rights are created in a democratic society, pass a law. And that law, unlike a constitutional right to abortion created by a court, can compromise. It can see. Oh, I was going to say it can split the baby. I should not use. A constitution is not meant to facilitate change. It is meant to impede change, to make it difficult to change.
You agree with that, Laura?
I agree that that's his interpretation of the Constitution. The alternative approach is that the Constitution is a sort of a matrix from which we can project onto the modern era with modern problems and modern concerns and visions of the proper way to have a society.
But it's interesting, Jeffrey, he says on the court, I guess, is that we don't compromise. That's what they do in the legislature. That's what they do in Congress. That's where the compromise should take place, but not on the court.
Well,
am I overinterpreting there?
He's saying you shouldn't bend your views of the Constitution to reach a result that people find politically congenial, and that was his the essence of his philosophy. It's important to note here the major criticism of Justice Scalia, which is that there were lots of occasions in which he seemed to betray his constitutional philosophy of originalism. So liberal critics said, well, if you're going to criticize Roe v. Wade, what about Bush v. Gore? It is impossible to reconcile the idea that the Constitution requires every ballot to be counted in the same way with the fact that the framers of the 14th Amendment clearly did not intend it to apply to voting rights at all, period. And there's no dispute about that historically. Scalia's response to that criticism, get over it, which was not. And also Brown versus Board of Education, very hard to justify on originalist grounds because both the framers and ratifiers of the amendment clearly did not intend it to prohibit school segregation. Scalia never had a good response to that in public. I had this wonderful dinner with him years ago, and I just posed the Brown question point blank, and he had a belly laugh, and he said, well, you know what? No theory is perfect. So there were lots of—
So he should get over it?
Well, maybe he should get over it. There were plenty of occasions in which, you know, people said he was an inconsistent originalist. The argument on the other side is there were lots of other occasions where his constitutional and political preferences did diverge. Like all of us, he was, you know, he wasn't perfect, and he acknowledged this.
Laura?
Yeah, the Brown versus Board of Education, I think, was a real sticking point for him. And there was actually some confusion for some time as to whether or not he believed that it was an appropriate and proper interpretation of the 14th Amendment, because, in fact, it's actually very difficult to justify on the basis of the legislative history of the 14th Amendment. But he did ultimately make clear that he believed Brown was good law and that it was properly decided. In terms of the criticism of the justice, it was often pointed out that, in fact, if you looked at the bottom line of his decisions, because he was so intelligent and so talented, was able to deploy originalism to reach consistently conservative results.
And he did he have on the court, did he have his other side? I mean, someone who had a very different interpretation of the Constitution, who could sort of push back Jeffrey against Justice Scalia?
Well, all of the liberal justices pushed back in different ways. Justice Stevens, the senior justice from liberal justice for much of his tenure, had these fiery dissenting opinions, both in the Citizens United case, where Stevens said, hey, the framers of the original First Amendment never conceived of corporations as persons. The modern corporation as we knew it didn't exist. And in fact, there was a strong anti-monopoly tradition dating back to Thomas Jefferson, who proposed a constitutional amendments that would have restricted monopolies that Scalia seemed to ignore. To his decision in the Heller case, which we should certainly talk about, this is Scalia's most important majority decision, recognizing the Second Amendment as an individual right to bear arms. And Justice Stevens's dissent said, no, the framers, most of the revolutionary bills of rights on which the James Madison drew were more concerned about prohibiting a federal standing army from disarming state militias. Only one, Pennsylvania, interestingly as it happens, viewed it as an individual right to bear arms. Listeners, you can check this out at the ConstitutionCenter.org's phenomenal interactive constitution. You can count up the state declarations yourself. But those are two examples of how Justice Stevens and other justices took Scalia on originalist terms and said that he was a faithless originalist.
I mean, this Heller decision, Laura, is such an important one, having to do with the Second Amendment and Scalia's interpretation. It's about the individual right to bear arms.
It's actually it's a model and that's used to actually teach law students about originalism and how, in fact, an originalist interpretation can be played out in very ambiguous language. I would say that Justice Brennan at the beginning of Scalia's tenure would have been the major liberal justice to push back on his approach and articulating an alternative view, a living constitution view to interpreting constitutional terms.
About Citizens United versus FEC, and this goes back to January 2012, Scalia said, "I don't care who's doing the speech, the more the merrier. People are not stupid. If they don't like it, they'll shut it off." And I remember, I guess it was one of Obama's early State of the Union addresses where he kind of called out the Supreme Court, Jeffrey, on this. And Alito, you know, shook his head no.
That was an amazing moment. It was soon after Citizens United. Obama said this would unleash the floodgates of foreign contributions into American elections. Justice Alito did shake his head and say not true. As it turned out later, technically Alito may have been right because Citizens United didn't affect the foreign contributions that Obama was talking about. But more broadly, it was a sign of how passionately Obama was opposed to the decision. Interestingly, you know, Justice Roberts was asked, what did you think of that? He said, if this keeps going on, I don't think we justices will come to the State of the Union. The next year, Roberts came. Alito did not. I think his office said that he had an important dentist appointment or something like that. But it was a big confrontation between the president
and the court. Citizens United is often pointed out as a example of an inconsistent vote by Scalia, recognizing that this right to freedom of expression somehow extends to corporation. That's considered by many to be quite a creative reading of the Constitution and not necessarily something that's tethered to original intent.
And again, that's Laura Little, professor of law and government at Temple University School of Law, Beasley School of Law. Jeffrey Rosen, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, talking about Justice Antonin Scalia, some of his decisions, some of his dissents, and we've been playing some clips as well. And we will be shifting gears talking about the political battle that happened, frankly, shortly after Justice Antonin Scalia's death over the weekend, about what will happen, the political fight over his replacement. In the meantime, call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I'll just read a couple of emails here just so people know what folks are thinking about. An email from Richard: please do not indulge in sainting a guy who was a strong personality but fell in love with a very questionable interpretation of the Constitution. An email from Mike: Scalia's dissent about laws limiting gay rights substitute mixed race in his arguments. A comment from Art: one of his lasting legacies will be restrictions to access on the court because of his rulings on standing. Seems like he tilted access toward corporations and away from individuals. So clearly a justice that has sparked a lot of dissent and opinion. Let me go back to something you wrote, Jeffrey. In writing about Justice Scalia, you sent him a letter. You were just out of law school. This was 1993. He wrote you back, and you wanted to interview him. And he said, since being a judge, I've had a uniform policy of declining interviews for articles about me. That policy undoubtedly has its costs, but it's in accord with our judicial tradition of avoiding publicity. Later in life, it seemed like he enjoyed the publicity of being interviewed and the publicity that came from being the justice that he was.
He does. That really seems like a missive from an ancient era,
time
when the justices would say that they didn't talk in public. And I think the norm shifted for all the justices. Part of that was TV and C-SPAN and direct access to the media. But there's no question that over the years, he became extremely outspoken. He was criticized in some cases for prefiguring his views on cases. He was asked to recuse himself from the case involving the In God We Trust on the currency by sort of suggesting that he thought it was fine, and other cases as well. He was here in Philadelphia at the Union League in November. It was such an honor to see him then. A bunch of us had that incredible experience. And he was very expressive about his views. One thing that was striking is he was asked, what do you think about the future of federalism, about federal-state relations? He said, I think it's dead. He said, I think ever since the 17th Amendment eliminated the ability of state legislatures to choose senators, and senators are now directly elected, the ability of states to have their interest represented is finished, and I think there's no way of getting it back.
Hmm.
Very interesting. And that was just one example of the fact that this was not someone who hid his opinions under a bushel. He was very, very happy to express them in public.
I mean, Laura, could we say that his constitutional ideas and opinions, I mean, were very much what he personally believed?
I think he was completely motivated by a self-referential approach, the idea that he truly believed that what he believed was correct. If you look at sort of the history of how he conducted himself on the bench and how over time he became more and more active outside of the Supreme Court, it appears as though he had made the decision that he would get his message out in ways other than through Supreme Court opinions, number one. But number two, I think he found his voice as a performer. I think as his career went on, his performance during oral argument was much more of a show than simply just trying to ask questions or sort of make the debate go in one way or the other.
Let me get some callers in. We've got, looks like John from Powelton Village joining us on Radio Times. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I just wanted to raise two very quick points. One is about the justices, what I perceive as complete lack of civility in various instances. And I don't think that really has been much acknowledged. I mean, the Obergefell decision, not only did he talk about putting a bag over his head, but he also referred to the majority opinion as pretentious and really went after Justice Kennedy on a very personal basis. And going back to the Lawrence case during oral argument, he used a metaphor that sort of shocked people and was very offensive. And it's so offensive, in fact, that I'm not even comfortable talking about it on the air. And I wonder if your guests might address that. The second point about convenient originalism, I think, has already been addressed by the callers. If they want to make further comments, I'd be happy to hear
sure.
that.
Sure. No, John, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Laura, can I toss that back to you about lack of civility, as John sees it?
I think Jeffrey sort of referred to it earlier, that during the beginning of his tenure as a justice, he had a much stronger filter, and he was much more amenable to being controlled and edited. As time went on, as often happens as people age, they are what they are, and they their filter starts to fall away. And I agree that he did indeed say things that were very hurtful to other people.
Well, including kind of comparing homosexuality to murder. I mean, he made – that's saying it too strongly here. I'm looking at a quote here and I'm stumbling around. But I thought that one could – this is in the Romer v. Evans case, 1996. I thought that one could consider certain conduct reprehensible, murder, for example, or polygamy or cruelty to animals, and could exhibit even animus towards such conduct. Surely that is the only sort of animus at issue here, moral disapproval of homosexuality conduct. I'm stumbling over the words here. But he seemed to be making some parallel between – homosexuality and animal cruelty.
I would not say that. I don't think that. He's saying that historically moral disapproval was a permissible basis for law. Look, murder law is based on moral disapproval. Why can't it be the basis for laws against gays and lesbians? Now the debate has changed. The Supreme Court said in Lawrence and in cases after that, that moral disapproval is not a legitimate basis for laws. And nowadays, people are not comfortable making those arguments. But I completely agree with John and Laura. All of us agree. By the end of his career, he was saying stuff in written opinions that were not in his interest and that were hurtful. And really, he could have used a filter. But this particular point, I just think, was a powerful one that he made constitutionally. What was it in the Constitution that changed so that moral disapproval was no longer a legitimate basis for laws?
You want to add to that, Laura?
Just that it's important. It's the distinction which he expressed himself between attacking another human being and debating about ideas. And I think that what you quoted from the opinion is on the ideas part of the realm, which is fair game for the very, very difficult questions that constitutional litigation present to the justices.
Let me see what Chris from Devon has to say. Chris, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Do we have Chris? We will get Chris. Go ahead, Chris.
The main point I wanted to make is that the idea of originalism, it should not be given the degree of respect it gets from the nation here. You know, what this is so typical of the Republicans, they tie their personal beliefs and their opinions to something like the Constitution. He frames his all his ideas, and he says, I know what the framers meant. Only I can interpret. All of my ideas line up with theirs. Nobody knows for sure what the framers meant. Even their ideas were changing constantly up until the day they signed it. There was bickering, and there was disagreement as to what should be in the Constitution. So how he can align himself and give himself this posture where he says he knows what they meant, that's something that should be questioned far more stridently, I think.
Well, Chris, I'm glad you raised it. Jeffrey, go ahead.
Well, it's a good challenge, Chris. I would say there are lots of liberals, ranging from Justice Kagan to Ronald Dworkin, who is probably the most important liberal political philosopher of his time, to Akhil Amar at Yale Law School, friend of the National Constitution Center, to groups like the Constitutional Accountability Center, who agree with Justice Scalia that text and history are relevant. When I was a law student, I was inspired by that challenge. The idea that when you're interpreting the Constitution, you should look at the words, you should look at what the framers mean, and then you should translate those understandings in light of new technologies and new circumstances seems to be correct. And I also was inspired by Justice Scalia's idea that you should separate your political from your constitutional conclusions. Now, Chris, you're right that finding out what the framers intended is not easy. And as he grew older, Justice Scalia was more likely to say, oh, all these questions are easy, whereas when he was younger, he was more willing to acknowledge complexity. But the challenge that he laid down, that we should try to understand the original public meaning of the Constitution and then translate it, is ones that I think it was a constructive one, and liberals and conservatives have taken up. The last thing I'll say is, if you want to see lots of examples where liberals believe that original understanding should point to progressive rather than conservative results, check out the work of scholars like Akhil Amar or the Constitutional Accountability Center. They're filing briefs every day to kind of make this progressive originalism possible.
Laura, I know you want to say something. We just have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to you and back to our other guests, Jeffrey Rosen, Laura Little from Temple University Law School. Jeffrey Rosen, President, CEO of the National Constitution Center. We are talking about Justice Scalia. Going to take a very short break, talk a bit more, and then we do want to talk about the political battle that's been brewing in the last couple of days. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with Jeffrey Rosen, head of the National Constitution Center, Laura Little, professor of law and government at Temple University School of Law. And we are talking about Justice Antonin Scalia, one of the most influential, one of the most outspoken justices to have served on the high court. I know you wanted to say something to Chris about this whole notion of originalism or original intent, Laura. It's like, how could Justice Scalia know what the framers were thinking?
There was a very important component to Chris's point that I wanted to highlight, because it's one of the difficulties of originalism as well as statutory interpretation as a general matter, that is trying to figure out what Congress meant, not just the framers of the Constitution. And that is that the words that are chosen by a collective body. And each component, each person may have their own view of what it meant. So it's unrealistic. It's not quite correct to say that one word has one meaning according to the framers, because there were several framers of the Constitution. And that's one of the flaws to originalism.
Well, let me shift gears here. And I think it must be said, it did not take long. Shortly after Scalia died, already the fight began over whether the president has the right or even the responsibility to pick a replacement for Justice Scalia. And let's hear what the president had to say. And this was back just a couple of days ago on Tuesday.
We have more than enough time to go through regular order, regular processes. I intend to nominate somebody, to present them to the American people, to present them to the Senate. I expect them to hold hearings. I expect there to be a vote.
Going to you, Jeffrey, does the president, I mean, is the president correct on that? And what does the Constitution say about the rights and responsibilities of the president of the United States?
Well, the Constitution says that the president shall, with the advice and consent of the Senate, make nominations. And we can certainly talk about the history of contested confirmations. As usual in these cases, you can argue them round or argue them flat. And I think everyone acknowledges the confirmation process is where constitutional law and politics converge. So you really can't – no one could claim that the Constitution tells us exactly what to do here. Briefly, I think the history suggests that there have been nominations in election years. My hero, Louis Brandeis, was nominated on January 28th and got a hearing on had a hearing and was confirmed on June 1st. His was the longest time, 125 days between nominations and confirmation. But that was a Democratic president and a Democratic Senate. When you look at Republican Senates and Democratic presidents, 1895, Grover Cleveland was the last one where a nominee got through. And it was a less polarized time. Mm-hmm. Abe Fortas was filibustered, never got an up or down vote when during Johnson's lame duck. I guess you could say descriptively that if President Obama's nominee does not receive a hearing or an up or down vote, it would be the longest time between nomination and confirmation in American history. I think that's a factual statement. Beyond that, I suppose it's kind of all politics.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly feels that way, Laura, but let's say that happens, and you've got a Supreme Court with eight justices, in many ways divided very evenly between liberals and conservatives, although I guess Kennedy still has that potential of being the swing vote. Does that hamper the U.S. Supreme Court if nothing is done on trying to find Scalia's replacement?
Sure. It totally prevents the court from doing its constitutional duty. At the moment, we have a fairly tenuous balance, four consistent liberals, three consistent conservatives with Justice Kennedy more in the conservative part of the court, but not always. Right. That would lead to an equally divided court on many of the contentious issues. That would lead to an equally divided court, indeed, on many of the issues that are currently before the court during this term. The consequence is that for those cases that have been argued but have not been handed down, that it's quite possible that Justice Scalia's vote will be void. There's not actually any specific case law or any rules on this point. In the courts of appeals, it's usually treated as a void vote when a judge dies. But it's not clear how Justice Roberts, who will be probably exercising a fair amount of power in this context, will handle every particular case. But the consequence of an equally divided court is to affirm the lower court decision. The lower court decision will remain precedent in that lower court, but the Supreme Court is giving up an opportunity to create Right. important law to provide guidance on issues for which reasonable minds differ. They're very, very difficult, and that's why the Supreme Court took it up. In the meantime, with the 4-4 decision, there's no precedent from the Supreme Court.
So, Jeffrey, what would Justice Antonin Scalia do? Or where do you think he would stand on this, what looks like a very contentious political stalemate?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, he would have said, I'm a justice, not a politician, and, Congress can do what it likes. The claims that the framers would have insisted on a vote are powerful because there's certainly nothing in either text or history or precedent that suggested that the confirmation process stops after in an election year. On the other hand, this is a much more – now that there's much more popular participation in the selection of the senators and the president with the 17th Amendment, which Scalia talked about, and the primary system – the idea that the people's should have a more direct role in the selection of justices is more powerful. So for all these reasons, I'll tell you this. My first job out of law school was I had the honor of working for then-Senator Biden during the Bork hearings. And Senator Biden gave a really influential speech in the Senate saying that it's important for the Senate to consider the ideology of nominees. And that was an unusual position at the time. Before that, it had just been you look at qualifications. But he helped transform the terms of debate. So now we believe that ideology matters when senators cast their vote. So if it matters, it's not a totally implausible position to say that this is going to change the balance of the court and therefore we're going to wait. So I can argue it both sides.
You can find it. Yeah. Go ahead, Laura.
I totally agree with that, that you could argue it both ways. Just to add a little bit in terms of what would the originalists say about what to do in this situation, I think you can glean from the Constitution a concern for ensuring that the government continues to operate. If you look at the recess appointment power, if you look at different provisions regarding succession for the president, there's a real concern with ensuring that the business of government goes on. So waiting for what really, if you think about it, may be 14 months. That is, you have to have the new president confirmed and take the oath of office, and then the president make the nomination, and then you have the confirmation hearings. That's quite a long way from now. So from that point of view, I think you could say that the Constitution very much supports going forward and appointing someone now. At the other hand, the Constitution did anticipate a politicized process. That is, by dividing the process of a Supreme Court justice taking the bench between the president nominating and the Senate providing advice and consent, it seems pretty clear that there was the anticipation with this checks and balances, as it were, that you would from time to time have divided government and a fight.
Well, that's a perfect setup. I do want to play a clip from Marco Rubio. He was on This Week with George Stephanopoulos just this last Sunday. And let me just add that Mitch McConnell very quickly said, you know, whoever Obama puts up, we're not going to essentially do anything or much of anything about it. Let's listen to what Marco Rubio said.
Mitch McConnell's already made it very clear that we're not going to move forward until there's an election. And I think that's the right decision. The court can function with eight justices. Now, the president can go ahead and nominate whoever he wants. The Senate shouldn't move forward on it until after the election. We're going to have an election in November.
So if you're elected president, will you promise not to make an appointment in your final year?
Yeah, well, I'm not saying the president can't make an appointment. I'm saying we're not going to move forward on it in the Senate. And that has been the practice now for over 80 years. He shouldn't. He has the legal right to do it. But and as president, I would recognize that precedent. And the precedent that's been set over the last 80 years has been that in the last year of a president's term, I mean, his second term especially, there should not be Supreme Court nominees put into lifetime positions for a president that you're not going to be able to hold accountable at the ballot box. There's going to be an election in November. This is going to be an issue in the election. The voters are going to choose a new president, and that new president, who I believe will be me, should then fill that vacancy for a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court.
So there's a question of precedent, as Marco Rubio describes it. There's the U.S. Constitution that you pulled out of your pocket, Jeffrey, to sort of...
right here, a National Constitution Center pocket Constitution.
I totally get it. I totally get it. But, you know, in terms of some kind of guidance, and I think of Stephanopoulos and some others, moderators, John Dickerson did this with Ted Cruz, basically saying, well, if you were in President Obama's situation, what would you do? Which gets to the politics of this whole thing.
That was it was a good question and an interesting answer. I'm trying to do the math. Is he referring to Cardozo? I'm trying to think of the last nominee who went through. Fortas, of course, was nominated, and had he not had problems with cronyism and objections to his jurisprudence, they might have broken the filibuster, but that was a Democratic Senate. Interestingly, Marco Rubio didn't say, I wouldn't make the nomination. He's sort of hedging on that question. I thought Laura's response was really thoughtful, and just thinking about 14 months and how unusual that would be and how disruptive that would be suggests the magnitude of the disruption that could follow.
Yeah, anything you want to add? Then we'll get back to our callers.
Just that the Constitution set up a process where the president is elected for 4 years. So presumably the sort of democracy that worked to elect the president would justify the president exercising constitutional power 3 years into his term.
And I generally think of lame duck after an election. So it's that, you know, 2 months at the most between an election and whenever the next president comes in, that's the lame duck session, not the last entire year of the president.
I suppose one question is, can we envision any scenario under which Obama, President Obama's nominee would get a hearing and could get confirmed. Senator Grassley said just the other day that he thought perhaps there should be a hearing. If there is a hearing and it's an extremely compelling nominee, say one not had confirmed by the Senate previously unanimously to the lower court, you could imagine some Republicans breaking off. But remember, you need a filibuster-proof majority. That's 60 votes, pretty hard to achieve if the Senate Republicans have a united front.
And I should just add, just to complicate things further, when President Obama was Senator Obama, he was part of a filibuster against Alito.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
just
yeah.
to be fair here, let me get Clinton from Drexel Hill to join our conversation. Clinton, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to ask a question about Section 3 of Article 2 of the Constitution. It seems here that President Obama, if he wanted to, could convene Congress and put this to a debate between the Senate and or the House of Representatives or both, and then upon a disagreement, send them home until he thinks that they should come back and play nice.
Well, you know what? Clinton, Jeffrey Rosen is looking at Section 2, Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution.
Thank you. I have my pocket constitution here. You can get it online. But listeners, go to constitutioncenter.org. Check out our phenomenal interactive constitution where you hear the best liberal and conservative voices in America writing about the meaning of every clause. So I'll read it here. I put on my constitutional reading glasses. And it says that the president, among other things, shall from time to time convene both houses or either of them. And in cases of disagreement between them with respect to the time of adjournment, he may adjourn them to such time as he thinks proper. So, yes, great point. He could call Congress into session. He could force them to come. He can't compel them to have an up or down vote, and he can't prevent a filibuster. But that's a really interesting suggestion, that if he's frustrated by Congress's refusal to consider his nominee, why not force them at least to convene and talk about it? Great idea.
Yeah, Clinton, I appreciate
political theater.
Yeah,
indeed. I would watch that. Yeah. Let me get John from Westchester to join us. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, a subject on which your guests have not commented, but which is very, very important to me, is that there are principles that govern judges and justices that go even beyond the Constitution. And one of the most important of these is the doctrine of stare decisis, the doctrine that once you decide an issue, it's decided, and that stability in the law is a necessary and good thing all by itself. And I believe that the conservative justices have been very activist and have basically emasculated in recent years the doctrine of stare decisis.
Well, John,
I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Sure. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Laura, can I toss that to you?
I guess Justice Scalia would respond to you that the power behind originalism is, in fact, aligned with stare decisis, that what it does is it constrains discretion, and in the same way that stare decisis, that's what has occurred before, also constrains discretion. I think the allegation of activism it applies to both sides of the fence and is not necessarily confined to conservatives.
And just on that point, I agree. And if Justice Scalia is replaced by a liberal justice, then the new liberal majority will have to decide how much it cares about stare decisis. And already several justices, like Justice Ginsburg and others, have said they want to overturn Citizens United. If they suddenly have the votes to overturn a whole host of decisions that they think are wrong, from voting rights to affirmative action to Citizens United, then the goose will I'm not even trying to mix my metaphor. The shoe will be on the other foot, and liberals will have to decide how much they care about stare decisis. I think I agree with the caller that stare decisis has not much constrained the conservatives, but it hasn't really constrained the liberals either. And if they have a majority, then they'll really have to show us how much they care about it.
Well, to be continued. It will be a very interesting, if not year, certainly the next couple of months. My thanks to both of you. Jeffrey Rosen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Laura Little, thank you for joining us.
Sure.
And she's the Charles B. Klein Professor of Law and Government at Temple University's Beasley School of Law, working on a book called Humor and the Law. Jeffrey Rosen is the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, right across across the street from us here in Philadelphia. And he's got a new book coming out June 1st called Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. And my thanks to all those phone calls and all the comments. A very interesting conversation. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.